This week on Writers, Inc.
I do strongly believe as a writer, if you are really convinced this is what you want, you have to give it your everything. And if you like that business side of it as well, and I kind of did.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories. All have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, it's Christine Daigle.
I'm Jenna Brown.
And I'm Kevin Tomlinson.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc. That was not Jenna.
Spoilers.
That was a poor imitation of poor Jenna.
That was a spot on. That was dead on. And when she hears it, she's going to say, oh my God, I didn't realize I was on that episode.
So I've got good news. I totally spaced on this when we were talking just a second ago. I finally met my new neighbors.
Oh
yeah.
And they are nice, which is awesome.
That is
like
awesome.
I think at this point we were ready for Jeffrey Dahmer to move next door. It would have been better than what we had. But yeah, they're very nice people. They actually invited us over yesterday and they gave us a tour of the house. And like my wife and I both have the same problem. Like we get this like PTSD kind of moment, like just looking at the house, you know, let alone like she walked up there a couple of days ago and just left an envelope with our contact info on the door. And like she was pale as a ghost when she walked back down those steps just from going up there. And like stepping inside of it, like to me, it's like stepping in like the 10th circle of hell. Like I do not want to be in there. Wow. You know, and it's, I'm trying to wrap my head around the fact that, you know, this is brand new owners, totally different. They were even in there saging the place, you know, so if there's evil spirits, they're gone now.
Do they have kids?
They do not. They've got, it looks like two little dogs. They've got grown up kids. They've got 20 something kids.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
20 something kids.
They don't live here anymore. They, you know, it's, this is kind of their retirement home.
Nice.
But, oh, all right.
Yeah. Nice. Kevin, you were mentioning something about Novel November.
Yeah. So a lot of folks, including Pro Writing Aid, are sponsoring this as a replacement for NaNoWriMo is Novel November. It's kind of filling the gap. I think people know by now that Nano shut down, but it's the same sort of premise. You write a book in 30 days. You might even be able to earn some rewards as you go. And they've got kind of a panel of best-selling authors. It's like 150 sessions of advice to kind of help you along the way and encourage you along the way. But if you want to register, I've set up a Bitly link. It's bit.ly/novnov25.
Cool.
Very difficult to say, but easy to type.
So are you going to do it?
I do National Novel Writing Month every month. Why would I? So, no, yeah, I support it, though. I mean, I like the idea that they're kind of, you know, stepping in to fill the void. And a lot of our, a lot of folks in the self-publishing industry, a lot of the companies have come together to support this. I think Draft to Digital's supporting it. And I think Craig Martell actually was part of the impetus to get this going. But Pro Writing Aid is the one that reached out to me first and asked if I would talk about it. So
I'm almost done an outline. Maybe I'll check it out. Get that outline done and try and bang it.
That's cheating. You're not supposed to start with an outline. You're supposed to start with nothing.
I'll do what I want.
I'm kind of in the same boat because I finished up a book with Patterson and I'm going back to the three prequels for 4MK. I've got the first two written, so I spent the last like 2 weeks or so going through and rereading those two books.
Yeah.
Got to the end of that process yesterday, and today loaded up the, you know, the Scrivener file and created a brand new novel and basically started the new one. And I'm going to kind of pants this one. I mean, I've got a little bit of a framework because I have to follow what happens in the trilogy, because they're both playing off each other, the existing trilogy.
Yeah.
But beyond that, I don't think I'm going to outline anything. I think I'm just going to hit the ground running and see what happens. So maybe I'll do this.
I'm kind of I'm mostly pantsing the book I'm working on now. One thing is happening for me right now is that we're downsizing and we're selling our stuff, and we're going to sell the house and everything. And that has like eaten my life. Like it's Every waking moment is, calling through things, feeling the heartache of letting things go.
Do you have actual like empty rooms at this point?
Well, so what we keep doing is this Jenga exercise of moving things out of one room and moving, we're going to keep all this stuff. So we move it into that room and we're selling items on like Facebook Marketplace. So all the big stuff we're selling is in another room. And it's just been like that. But the garage right now is completely packed with garage sale stuff. We're going to have the first of several garage sales on Saturday, the 18th. And then, we're hoping they sell everything, but we've already committed to like, I don't want the people coming to the garage sale to know this, but if we don't sell it, we're donating it. So, I'm hoping that people will come and buy all of it.
Yeah. This will air after the garage sale, so it'll be fine. They won't.
Yeah. Yeah. Too late.
Cool. Suckers. All right. What is in the news?
Well, Frankfurt is in the news. Frankfurt Book Fair 2025, real talk about what matters. From the opening press conference and into the first day of the show, programming leaned heavily on the challenges facing the industry, as well as emerging opportunities in the changing IP landscape. One of the biggest challenges facing European publishers is how to seduce readers away from screens. The reader problem is interest and time, not just price. Nearly half of Europeans report reading no books, with big gaps by education and gender. The takeaway was blunt: make books sexier and easier to choose. IP now breaks out everything. Hit adaptations can start as Reddit threads or podcasts, yet book to film still rules festival winners. Storytellers should hunt ideas across platforms while keeping books at the center.
Yeah. The two things that were really interesting to me, or I don't know, interesting for the first one, more horrifying, is that only like 1.2% of readers said price was a barrier. Everyone else just said, I don't read. There was like 50%. I don't read. I don't have time to read was about 80%. I don't like that.
I don't either. I actually went to give blood the other day. Not give blood. It was, for my doctor gave me a stack of pages that I had to take with me to various tests and stuff. But it's kind of just a routine blood draw. And like the girl that did it, she knew me just from around town and knew I was an author. And she said she doesn't read. And like, it made me feel so sad, And like, I almost wanted to hand her a book and try to convert her, like a drug dealer giving that free taste or something. But, it's happening more and more, and I see it just when I go over to my daughter's elementary school, like they're, there's kids with phones now even at that age, so they're already in that, and just walking down the street, you walk through, like I cross our beach every day when I do a run and there's people out there. Very few have physical books, or they're staring at phones. And I like to tell myself they're reading a book on their phone. But that is probably a lie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the hope. Yeah. The other thing that was interesting is that IP, there's, getting ideas from social media or podcast or Reddit threads. I mean, that's not traditional of where you find IP ideas for films and stuff.
It kind of can be. I mean, if you go back, years ago, like I would pick up the newspaper and just, go through headlines. Mm-hmm. And I still get tons of emails of like weird events that happen in newspapers and, different parts of the world and stuff like that. And I peek through that. So I can see people combing, this kind of thing, looking for stuff.
I follow a lot of like weird history, lost history stuff on Twitter. So a lot of ideas come from that, and usually it's something I've kind of seen before, but it sort of reminds me, but every now and then they'll pop up with something I'd never heard of. And so I go down that rabbit trail and look for.
Well, honestly, I mean, maybe that's how you cross that line, right? You everybody starts talking about something on Reddit and all of a sudden you turn that into a book, you pull the core idea out and turn it into something. Maybe that's how you rope those Reddit readers into actually reading a full novel.
I mean, best way to do it would be to write the book and then leak the weird facts from it on Reddit with, lots of mentions of this book explores that whole idea. And then maybe they go, maybe it becomes viral. Who knows?
Yeah,
who knows? Whatever.
That's how you end up with a post about, hey, this author is seeding stuff in Reddit trying to sell their book.
Yeah, whatever. authors are like heroin addicts. We're always chasing that high. So All right, next up, speaking of heroin, good vibes at New York Comic Con. Big energy, big sales. Retailers reported a 27% sales bump in 2025. Artist Alley saw sellouts. DC returned to the floor after 13 years and revived Vertigo with 10 new series. Retail trends look strong. Shops see an influx of young readers via manga, webtoons, and print. Romanticy, don't know this word,
Isekai, Isekai.
Isekai. That's
We'll
an
go with
I.
that.
Isekai and Lit RPG. Dungeon Crawler Carl's graphic novel spinoff crowdfunded over $1.6 million in a week. Quote, blind bag variants and compact editions drive discovery. Vibes match the numbers. The show floor was packed. Publishers engaged retailers. Pro networking space expanded. And even with cosplayers grumbling about a smaller zone, the takeaway was clear. Fans want escapism and comics are delivering. I do love comics.
Yeah.
So maybe that's where the readers went.
That's where they went. They're all so I did look up that isekai. I don't know because I was like, I don't know what that is either. But it's a Japanese subgenre of fiction where the protagonist is transported, reincarnated, or trapped in a different world. So there you go. Now you've
Oh,
learned something.
okay.
And I was part of that 1.6 million that funded that Dungeon Crawler Carl. I love that
Yeah.
series. It's so good.
Did you guys meet him last year when he
I
was at
did. He was so nice.
Authorization? He's a good guy.
I petted his princess donut.
Not a euphemism. All right.
No, that is the stuffed cat with a tiara from the book. Oh,
They
God,
all say
Kevin.
that. No, so I think there's a so I think comics are kind of still the uncrossed territory for a lot of writers because
Yeah.
it's difficult. And I know that some people are starting to use like AI to generate art or whatever, but it's still kind of hit or miss. But it's a difficult process to create at an indie level, and most indie comics just bomb. I mean, it just because they're too expensive to create, take too long to create, can't maintain it without some backing from one of the, like I think there's five big names in comics, and without some backing from those groups, it's really difficult to crack the market. And their distribution is practically, non-existent outside of. And I forget the name. Some of the channels for distribution have just completely disappeared now. So it's a difficult market to crack.
Is it like a mailing list thing? Do these five, do they have just big mailing lists of their clients, and that's how they push a new title?
They lean heavily on the shops.
Comic shops.
I always thought that the mailing list thing would be the way to go, but you got to get the discoverability, and people still they a lot of people are reading comics digitally now, but the comic book shops are still where it's at, is what I've been told.
Yeah.
And so if you can't get a presence in the shop, and the what I'm hearing are grumblings that these bigger companies will shut a shop out if it's stocking indie titles or something, and so there's less incentive to do that. So like you got to carry Batman, Superman, you got to carry Spider-Man. If you don't carry these titles, people don't come to the shops. And so if those company if Marvel and DC and the and their parent companies are strong arming you not to carry competitors, you're kind of stuck.
Yeah.
That's a conspiracy theory, I guess, but I've heard it from enough people in the industry that I'm starting to think there's some tiny truth to it.
That is horrible. Yeah.
Yeah, it's horrible. And I think something's got to give, though. And someone's going to come up with a great idea that will solve the problem. And I tried to be that someone, but I don't know. There's just too much, there's too many factors. And I'm not knowledgeable enough about that side of the business to really do it. But who knows? Maybe I'll have an inspiration. So next up, last up, the Pushkin Job, unmasking the thieves behind an international rare book heist. Between 2022 and 2023, a theft spree hit libraries across Europe, targeting rare 19th century Russian, quote, lifetime editions, especially Pushkin. About 170 books worth over 2.5 million pounds vanished, often swapped with crude lookalike pages that fooled busy staff and bypassed weak security on older books. A joint EU investigation tied many heists to a Georgian-led network using fake IDs and coordinated tactics. Those arrested described swapping originals for fakes and routing them via Minsk to a Russian buyer. Evidence shows planning and overlap among crews, but none of the originals have been recovered. Who's behind it? And it remains unsettled. Could be private collectors or something closer to state-enabled repatriation. Warsaw librarians say some stolen volumes surfaced at a Russian auction house, and with Russian EU cooperation frozen, investigators fear the books are gone for good.
There's probably a book in that, right? A book in what's actually happening to the books.
Yeah, I've actually.
This was a wild read. Like, I recommend reading this whole thing. It's kind of long. It's on The Guardian. It's free. But it was like just trying to figure it out. So they ha caught this one couple who had swapped their fakes with fakes of books that had already been stolen. And it was
Yeah.
like, were the first people trying to cover their tracks in the level of detail, like the whole thing was fascinating. So it's worth a read.
I remember a few years ago, the big thing was for there were people who were going sneaking into archives, and they would sneak razor blades in with them, and they would actually remove pages from some of these manuscripts that had like original artwork or something, and then so they would resell that. But stealing the entire book and replacing it with a phony low grade version of it is kind of nefarious.
It is. Yeah.
I mean, you really have to know what you're looking for too when you walk in there. Like that's, it's not a one and done kind of thing. I mean, they've got to visit, figure out if particular titles are there, then they've got to find the fake and go back. So there's multiple trips involved. I mean, first editions for some books are worth a fortune. I've personally never thought about going to a library to find a first edition, but I bet you that's where a lot of them are. There was a library in Dublin called Marsh's Library that Dacre Stoker and I went to because Bram Stoker used to hang out there when he was a kid. And they actually had pages in the library. So like if you wanted to read one of their books, and their books went back to like the 1500s, 1600s, they would lock you in a cage with the book. And then, when you gave the book back, they let you out of the cage.
And that was with these. They were so they would have to have them called up. So they're traveling on fake IDs. We're researching 17th century Russia, whatever. So they had people bring these books out of storage for them and distract the librarian while one made the change. And it was just like very, very, very sneaky. I don't know.
Yeah, you can get into some real like Ocean's 11 stuff with these things. And that, by the way, is like the whole premise of John Grisham's book, Camino Island, as the theft of some like original, like F. Scott Fitzgerald, like handwritten manuscripts out of this archive. So I don't know. It's a fascinating world. And there are books and documentaries about all this that are, and they're mind-blowing to just see that story. I mean, and this really would make a good this would make a great novel. I don't think I'm qualified to write it, but I'd sure like to try.
In November, right?
November, you
November,
can
I'll
write
write it in November.
it.
Yeah, it'll be 50,000 words written in a stupor in November. That
And then
that'll
tell
do
me
it
when it gets
justice.
published, and I'll go to the library and steal it and swap
Steal
it with a fake.
it. You have a story. Share it with the world. Ingram Spark offers everything you need to publish, promote, sell, and print your book. Reach millions of readers worldwide with powerful tools created for independent authors. Get started for free at ingramspark.com/learn more.
Oh, on that note, JD, who is up this week?
This week, we've got Thomas Oudehooiveld coming on. Thomas is an international best-selling author from the Netherlands, and his first translated book won a Hugo Award. He wrote one of my favorite books called Hex, and his latest novel is called Darker Days and releases October 28th. Here he is.
Okay, Thomas, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, you have a new book out, Darker Days, which we're going to talk about in a minute.
Oh, yeah.
Since it's your first time with us, we always like to start at the beginning. So I would like to know, how did you get your start in this business of writing and publishing?
It happened after my father died. That happened when I was 3 years old. Death was a presence in my life as a child. And my uncle sensed that. My uncle was a storyteller and he told me stories. And in his stories, he taught me that you can beat the monsters and you can beat the demons that are haunting you. And so he told me the good stuff. He told me Bram Stoker's Dracula when I was 8 years old and Frankenstein by Mary Shelley by when I was 9, I think. So he told me, you know, the stuff that actually helped me overcome my trauma. So in doing so, I kind of figured that, okay, so in stories, I can beat my monster. So that's what I've been doing since that age. I wrote stories. So I got my first novel published at 18 in the Netherlands. And I think Hex was my first translated novel that made it across borders.
Oh, wow. Well, I love that. And I like what you said there. I think like with horror, with fairy tales, that's really what it's about, right? Is facing the monsters, but leaving with hope and knowing we can survive, right?
Yeah. And I mean, because in the end, horror stories are about fear and the fears we have as human beings, whether we're children or whether we're adults, it doesn't make a big difference. And horror is the perfect mechanism to, you know, to try to deal with these fears. Not always beat them, because I don't know if it's possible, but at least, you know, fight them.
Yeah, at least fight them. So you had your first book was acquired. So that was not Hex. That was a different book that you had acquired in the Netherlands.
I wrote four books before I wrote Hex. Those books are happily unavailable around the world. They're my development novels, if you will. I mean, it's like looking back at childhood pictures. You know, as a teen, that's what I looked like. You know, let's just not look at that anymore. So Hex was the first one, actually, that I had the confidence. This is an amazing story, and I think this can reach readers around the world because of its horrors, but also because of its quirkiness and because of its Dutchness, in a sense. So, yeah, that's the one that, you know, that set out my career, if you will.
Yeah. So how did that happen? Were you working another job? You've written four novels.
No, I was a full-time writer immediately after university. The way I did it, like I said, my dad died when I was young. So through my college years, I lived off I got like a modest inheritance. It wasn't like big, but at least I didn't have to have a job while going through my college years, which meant I could develop myself as a writer. And then my money ran out and I had a choice to make. Either I had to get a real job or figure something out to make money of my writing. So what I did is I bluffed. I made a brochure in the Netherlands where I lived and I sent it to 500 high schools and colleges in the country. And in it, I said, you know, Thomas Oliver teaches writing workshops, speaks about his job. You know, he's asked many times. I wasn't asked at all. I mean, but I was young and I wrote the kind of stuff that the kids loved. So I was invited immediately right away. And I became a full-time writer ever since. And then, of course, I had that, you know, translation hurdle to cross, because I wrote in Dutch and I, you know, my work was in Dutch and translation is costly and it's complicated and it's an art form by itself. So I invested in the translation of short stories that I wrote. And I went to conventions in the US and the UK, like WorldCon, World Fantasy Con, those kind of genre conventions where I could meet editors, I could meet other writers, I could meet publishers, I could meet agents. And I just did what everyone do, you know, I just go to the bar, buy people drinks and see where it gets you. And it got me an agent. So.
I love that. You know, you wouldn't imagine how many times I've heard that people have met their agents drinking at a con.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
so is that how you got your agent? Is like at the bar at a convention?
Technically, the one that I ended up with, I met through Anne Vandermeer. She bought a story of mine for tor.com back in the day. And her husband, Jeff, was represented by an agent that she really thought was a nice fit for me. So she got us together and it worked out.
Wow.
The one that sold Hex to, I think, 25 countries around the world. It's amazing. Yeah.
So Hex, you wrote it in Dutch and then paid to have it translated to get it in the US market. Is that?
Yeah, I paid for like a sample translation. By then, I had, you know, a couple of short stories published. One actually won a Hugo Award at some point, so that made it a little bit easier. But yeah, I invested every last penny that I had in translation and travel to try to make it happen for me. And it worked out because, I mean, I do strongly believe as a writer, if you are really convinced this is what you want, you have to give it your everything. And if you like that business side of it as well, and I kind of did, then, you know, give it all you got. And like I said, I put all my money in, and it kind of worked out.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So let's fast forward. Now we're more than a decade later.
Yeah.
Do you still write in Dutch and have it translated?
I still write in Dutch. I still work with translators around the world. I mean, I rewrite my English translations.
Yeah.
Like I studied English in college. I studied American literature at college, so my English is pretty good. I don't know if I feel comfortable to actually write directly in English because Dutch is simply my mother tongue. It's
Right.
just easier. You have more freedom that way. But I do feel confident enough to edit the translation, and often the edit becomes a kind of rewrite, and I
Yeah.
see things. This can be a little bit better. This can be, you know, and my voice in English might differ a little bit than my voice in Dutch. It's never like a literal translation. So, yeah, I like to work on the translator with the translator. Also, because from English, it is then translated into many other languages.
Right. Yeah. It's interesting working with translators because they ask these questions like, there's literally no translation in our language for this. So, what would you like? And yeah.
Always. Yeah.
So, do you have a particular translator you work with, or is it various translators?
I've had various translators. I now work with the one I started out with, and she's fantastic. Her name is Leah Belt. She's the one also who translated my first short stories. She was the first ever translator to win a Hugo Award for the
Yeah.
story that I wrote, and she translated. So that was really awesome. But she's just really good, and I really click with her well. And yeah, she translated Darker Days, and she translates my new novel as well. Yeah.
That's great. That's great when you can have that relationship and, you know, she
Yeah.
gets your voice and all of that.
Yeah.
Okay, so and it, did you have a pretty big gap between Hex and your next novel? Was there quite a
Yeah.
few?
Hex and Echo, there was a gap in writing it and therefore also in publishing it
Yeah.
because I had to reinvent myself a little bit because the way Hex blew up, it was everything I ever wanted, but also everything nobody ever prepares you for. Like,
Right. Yeah.
you get this success. Like I said, it was translated into 25 different countries. And for like a boy from Holland coming from nowhere, basically, this very tiny country with its very tiny language group, to have Stephen King read and tweet about your book, My Childhood Hero, that was just mind-boggling. And then all these reviews coming in from around the world, and I toured on four different continents. So the pressure grew, man. I mean,
Yeah.
I just did not know how to deal with that. It was, like I said, everything I ever wanted, but it was also a huge pressure. And I didn't want to just repeat myself. I didn't want to write a Hex 2.0, if you will. I wanted to do something different and prove that I wasn't like a one-day fly. So that's why the next one, Echo, took me a long time to actually write. Normally, a novel takes me about 6 months. This
Yeah.
one, 3.5 years. Just because of all, you know, all the pressure of the career building. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, we talk about a little bit, but I don't think we talk about that enough. The sophomore novel, they call it, after you've had huge
Yeah.
success. And then
Yeah.
how do you deal with that? And
You're
you
kind
know,
of on your own because nobody
yeah.
really understands it except for people who've gone through that process. So I had a lot of help from writers both in Holland and in the States who are further down the line than I am, and that really helped me those conversations because they know what it's
Yeah.
like, and they can help you with the practicalities, and the basics are simple. I mean, it's just no whether you sell like 1,000 copies or 100,000 or 1 million, it doesn't really matter. It's
Yeah.
just you and the story you really like, and that never changes, and that's the basis of it all.
Yeah. Was there anything that helped you so other people helped you? But how do you kind of quiet those voices in your head saying you have to live up to the success? Like, how did you
I
manage
actually asked George R. R. Martin that question, who was
that?
famously still working on this. But I was asking him, like, how do you deal with the pressure? Because, the way that show blowed up his life and his career, and it brought him a ginormous amount of success, but also this pressure of having to finish those novels, and who knows if he ever will. But it's actually him who said, in the end, it all boils down to going back to the way you wrote when you started out, just you in your room, you and your story, and have fun at it. It's what he said. And that really helped me a lot to hear someone like him say that. Just have fun at it. Because that's key, I believe. If you have fun with a story, that shows on the page, and the reader will have fun with it too.
Yeah, I think that's the best advice. I've actually given that advice. When I get too serious, the work is not good.
No.
And it's I'm like,
When you think about audiences, or when you
yes.
think about publishers, or dates, or deadline, no, you just have fun with a story.
Yeah, I think have fun is the best advice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about your new book, Darker Days, which is a
Yeah.
modern take on a Faustian bargain.
Do you like this UK cover? This is amazing. This has the accountant, like the
Oh,
devil
that's
figure.
gorgeous. His head has
Yeah.
got like smoke coming out of it. I love seeing like the various covers.
Yeah, me
Yeah.
too.
It's so
Yeah.
interesting how they gear them to different countries and what they look like. So,
And somehow publishers always make it work for their market. Like
yeah.
any American, I show the US edition and the UK edition, they prefer the US edition usually. And any British person, they prefer the UK edition. It's somehow the publishers know
They
what the
know.
site read in their country's like. Yeah.
Yes, they know, which is good. They know that's what they get paid for, right? That's their job and they do
Exactly.
it well.
They're doing their job. Yeah.
So I'm curious, would you make a Faustian bargain for extraordinary luck and talent? Have you thought about this, wrestled with this problem?
I've definitely thought of it. I'd be lying if I say I wouldn't be tempted, because I mean, like this endless amount of happiness. I mean, who wouldn't want that? But this book is also about the sacrifices you have to make for it, right? And when I think of what makes me stand out as a writer, I thought of that a long time ago when I was developing myself. What can I bring to my stories and to the genre that I love that is original and fresh? Because I had no background in poverty like the way Stephen King grew up. I had no background in boarding schools like the way Roald Dahl grew up. I
Yeah.
was just this average, middle class kid in Holland that, hadn't gone through a lot. But then I thought, the Dutch are really practical, down to earth, kind of boring people. And I thought I'll embrace that practicality. So anytime I write a horror story, I take my Dutch practicality with it. So I figured if I would be confronted with a Faustian bargain where I have to bring this annual sacrifice, a human sacrifice, how would I go about it practically, right?
Yeah.
I don't just want to drag someone into the woods and kill them. I mean, I'm not like that, and you're not like that either. So how do you do that? And then I figured, you go to people who have wished to die, and
Yeah.
you offer them something that they cannot refuse. You help them actually to fulfill their wish and make it beautiful. And that might ethically make it a little bit less bad. And that's how this book started. It's ethically really dicey, but what these people are doing, but it's a really cool story, I think.
Yeah, and you get into that kind of assisted suicide, which can be a somewhat of a controversial topic.
It is. This book was 8 years in the making. I actually had the idea for it right after I finished Hex. But first, I didn't want to do like the small town trope again. This is not like a small town book. It's a single street with
Yeah.
five different families who have this bargain. But still, it felt a little bit familiar in that sense. But also, Like you said, there are some really sensitive topics in this book. Teen depression, assisted dying, suicide, all these quite, you know, sensitive topics that I didn't know how to tackle back then.
Yeah.
And I wrote two different novels before I felt ready for this one. And yeah, I mean, this book makes the case that, well, if you really have this wish to die and you can do it in a good and humane way, is that so bad? Should you have freedom to choose that or not?
Yeah.
You know, but then, of course, when these people are using it for their own happiness, that takes a different, you know, part of the equation. You know?
Yeah. It's a moral dilemma. It really does make you question, if I was in this situation, what would I do? Yeah. Which I think is the best kind of horror.
There's like a Le Guin story, like the ones who walk away from Omelette. Are you familiar with it?
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's about these people who live in this utopian town where they're extremely happy. And at the age of 18, they're taken down to the dungeons where there's one child who's kept in the dirt and he's tortured. And that's by the grace of that child, people have their happiness and people get the choice. Do you stay or do you walk?
Yeah.
And most stay, unfortunately.
Yeah. And, you know, that story has influenced so many other stories because it's such a horrible question. And I know you talked about it in your book about how easy it is to turn a blind eye to human nature if it makes you happier. Yeah.
We all do it, right? We all make choices for our own happiness, in the pursuit of our happiness. Like, we all go on vacation. We take a plane while we know we're destroying the planet. We like our steaks, but do we really care about how those animals are treated? We like, you know, cheap clothes, but do we really care about how they're made? There's all these immoral implications to the choices that we're making. And I'm not judging in this book. I never, you know, I'm not holding a finger or something. That's not my job. But at least want to make you think about the choices that you make. And also show that there's a very human side to these choices. Like, we all make them. And these most people in the book, they're very human. They're not monsters. They're not, they really generally try to do good.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, I can't remember who said it about the banality of evil. And that's really it is. It's just turning a blind eye. And we can really put blinders on to a lot of things.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
We stay in our own little bubble, right?
Yeah. And then, I mean, I love the family dynamic in the book because we see the story through the eyes of one family, two parents, two kids. One is 15, the other is 10. Because the family, I mean, they all love each other. They all turn against each other during the darker days, which is the period when their luck changes into bad luck in November. And they have to make that sacrifice. But their ethical judgment also lapses. So it becomes very messy in that month. But that family dynamic is a perfect mechanism for any kind of horror story because it's based on love and fear of losing each other's love.
Yeah. And it really makes you look at where do you draw that line, which is always good horror, in my opinion. The other thing you look at, which I have always been afraid of, is mirrors. Mirrors freak me out. Reflections.
Oh, yeah.
Has that been like a long-standing fear for you? Or?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, in there's this dynamic where when those darker days start, all the mirrors in the houses need to be covered.
Yeah.
And the kids just don't know why. It's just something they do. They're used to it. They're grown up with it. And they don't look. They may not look. And they may not look in their backyards because there's something terrible out there. It's so simple how to create this enormous fear and tension with things that are so... So familiar to us all. We all hate the look of mirrors because, I mean, who really likes to look at themselves? And then what if you see something move in the mirror behind you? You know, there's always that fear. And then there's these piles of branches that just show up in the backyards and in their homes everywhere. What comes out of it? I mean, it's just the very mundane things can sometimes turn really creepy, and that's definitely what this book does.
Yeah. So I'm curious, do you find yourself exploring things that are particularly creepy or unsettling to yourself, like over and over again? What are your kind of favorite fears, I guess?
Well, I mean, the fear that has been driving me throughout my life is the fear of losing your loved ones. That comes back in all my books. I wouldn't say it's my favorite fear, because my very unfavorite, because I am scared of it myself. Death following us. My dad died when he was 42. Wasn't supposed to happen on his age. I just turned 42 this year, so I'm now at his age.
Wow.
I actually, you know, now have lived longer than he did, which is a really weird feeling. But also, one of my best friends died a couple of years ago. He was 36, and then it just happened in the kitchen, and like it was a heart attack. Sometimes death does hit us when we're young, and that just freaks me out, because there's no signs. It can just happen in a flick. So when my partner is out on the road, I just get dead scared that he gets like an accident or something. Or when, you know, my sister is, you know, I can be afraid that their plane crashes, for instance, whether I know. At the same time, that statistically is completely unrealistic, but still the fear is there.
Yeah.
So that's what I've been writing about, fear of losing loved ones. In all my books, I think there's always the dynamic of losing, because that's what thrives a lot of good horror. There's also more mundane fears, like I just hate sharks. I've never written about that, but I hate sharks. I mean, and again, I know the statistics. I know we are way more harmful to them than they are to us. But when these mouths open and you got these jaws, and then, you know, sometimes I go cliff diving in the Mediterranean where I live, and each time that I jump off a rock, I just know that there will be this gaping mouth beneath me.
Oh,
and
boy.
Then I just try to still try to conquer those fears. And so far, there has not been a shark's mouth below me. So
that's good. Do you get sharks where you are? Is that a thing?
They are in the Mediterranean, even great white ones, but they're way deeper, I think. So they shouldn't come to shore. But when you see this deep blue water below you, I mean, statistics don't really help.
Yeah. And with, I guess, with the climate of the ocean, like, great whites are more places than they're supposed to be now, which freaks me out. I'm okay with sharks, but great whites, no thank you.
They're beautiful animals. It's just that they're so giant and which one bite just kills you, even if they don't mean to. So
yeah exactly. But yeah, I like what you said about the family. I think love and fear are really intricately tied, and I think that fear of losing a loved one is universal, so I think you can always get great horror out of that.
We all know it from falling in love, you know, whether you lose your love to because they're just simply breaking up with you, or because something really bad happens. You know, it's a driving factor in all of our lives, I think. Yeah.
Well, excellent. Well, this is a great book, and it will be out as we release this. So I'm just curious, do you have thoughts of what's coming next? Anything, plans you can share? Things you're hoping to explore?
Definitely. So Darker Days has been picked up for a television show.
Oh, wow.
Really exciting to see that develop. Some other of my books are in development for TV and film, which is really amazing. I'd love to see that. Visualized. I love the collaboration with filmmakers as well. I'm working with some of them together. It's really amazing.
Nice.
Also just finished a new novel this year. It's called The Last Story of Jamie Gunn.
Okay.
And that's a really personal book that will be out next year, probably, or maybe early 27 in English. It will be out in Dutch this fall. And it's a book about stories. It's a book about the power of stories, the way they can heal, but also the way they can destroy us. Because in the end, it's about a story that if you hear its ending, it will actually kill you. And it's about a boy who loses his father, who was his favorite storyteller. And he goes through the city where he lives, door by door, meeting strangers to ask about, you know, if they can tell him a story to give meaning to his father's death. he hears that story that actually kills you, and then when he grows up, he accidentally writes it.
Oh my goodness. Oh, that sounds like, wow, that sounds like a wild ride. So that would be
It
great.
is a wild ride, definitely.
Yeah. Okay, and I guess just as we wrap up, we have one question we like to ask everyone.
Yeah.
If you could give one piece of advice to other writers, maybe newer aspiring authors, what would it be?
One single piece of advice. So, aside from the usual stuff, read,
Yes,
write,
yes.
have fun at it, just what we talked about before. I always say to aspiring writers, go and look for the one thing that only you can bring to stories, the thing that makes you unique. Like I said, the way I thought with my kind of boring Dutch background, I had we had no literary tradition in horror. I had no originality to bring to the genre. I was wrong. Of course, I had originality to bring to the genre. I embraced what made me unique. And by doing so, I wrote these kind of quirky, practical dealings with the supernatural. Like when a woman with stitched up eyes is in your bathroom, you just hang a towel over her face and take a shower, like people do in Texas. That kind of is my is what I brought to the genre that springs from that discovery of who I was as a person and as a writer. So I always tell people, go look for that single thing that makes you unique and write the stories only you could write.
Thomas has had such a great career. I'm curious, we were talking about this before. Would you make a deal with the devil for tremendous success and happiness?
Sometimes I look at my life and I wonder if I actually did, and I was just drunk when it happened and I don't remember the transaction.
Can you give me
But
his contact info?
we're asking seriously, the answer is no. If we're asking jokingly, the answer is maybe.
Maybe. Well, we always ask jokingly, is anything serious? I don't know. But what I really loved is where, he was thinking about what he was going to bring to horror. And he said, well, I didn't grow up in poverty, so I don't have that perspective. And I didn't grow up ultra rich. I'm just kind of like a regular person. So what am I going to bring? And his answer was practicality. I'm going to bring practicality. But I think that actually works so well with horror, when you kind of make it a little more mundane, the mundaneness of life. I'm curious what you guys think about that practicality in horror.
I was actually just talking to an editor about the idea of mundane horror, and specifically we were talking about Cujo, because we were talking he was asking he was saying like he had just read something recent by King, and he was saying, I'm trying to find like a through line, because he had read something, and the promo for it said, from the writer who brought you Shawshank Redemption and Stand By Me. And he had this epiphany that like that's true of King, but then you'll have like from the writer who brought you Carrie and whatever, Cujo. And he's like, I'm trying to find what the through line is, and Cujo is the standout because it feels supernatural, but it's a very mundane, horror story, because he just gets rabies. I mean, millions of dogs a year get rabies. So but it feels spiritual in a sense, because you start to get this sense of that there's something else at play, a subtext to that story that's supernatural. So the mundane horror could be really existentially jarring, in my opinion.
If Cujo had been written by somebody other than Stephen King, or if he had put a different name on it, do you think that it would still feel that way?
I mean, that's hard to say, but
You're coming in with that preconceived notion because he's got, a couple scary supernatural paranormal type things going on before that,
But
and
I
then all of a
mean,
sudden a
you
story that
read
could
that.
happen. Yeah,
You've
absolutely.
read it, and there is something in the way that Stephen King handles a scene, especially mundane things. There's always the sense that there's something happening on a level above what you're reading. A lot of his stuff is like that, and sometimes he does a great job with it, and sometimes he doesn't. But he turns the mundane into horror better than most other writers I've ever encountered. So I don't know that just any writer could have done that. You know, if the book was called Fluffy and it was, you know, more of a sad old Yeller kind of tale, you know, I mean, that's one type of story. But I mean, naming him Cujo, it's like, where'd that name come from? You know, so that right there, it just sort of, it, because it stands out and it almost sounds supernatural. So, you know, the tone is set. I think it's true. Yeah, go ahead.
With Thomas, with Hex, you know, the story is basically about a town that has a witch problem. It's basically like a ghost witch, and nobody in the town can leave. And they all know that this ghost witch is there, and it's been there forever. So they're just used to it. And I think that's why the book works so well, because they just deal with it. You know, like you turn around at the grocery store and this ghost is standing behind you, and like it's happened to everybody in the town so many times, they don't get shocked anymore. They just throw a towel over her head or whatever, and just kind of move on with their life. You know, I think that's why it works so well. It was such a unique take on it. You know, it is mundane, but the fact that it's mundane is unique.
Yeah, and I think it's how we deal with real life horrors as well. Like, I don't know if you've had anything traumatic happen in your life. I definitely have. And the only way you can deal with it and move on is to be pragmatic. Like, you just kind of one foot in front of the other. So I think you said, you know, that lets us overcome our monsters. You just kind of, you're pragmatic about it, and the horror is there, but you move on, which I kind of like that explanation.
I think you saw that a lot in, you know, there are some pretty horrific situations in history, but I mean, if you look at Viktor Frankl and Man's Search for Meaning, that's the premise of that, of the whole, his whole book and that whole theory is that, you know, you have no control over the horrors that happen in your life. You only have control over how you know, decide you're going to perceive that and what it means to you. I think we do that by reflex sometimes. You know, you lose a child in a tragic car accident, you have no choice but to move on. I mean, your only other option is end your own life. So how do you live with this hole in your life and this wound in your life? And the answer is you figure out how to do it and you do it. And there's no rhyme or reason or logic to it. It's just something you end up having to do.
And losing someone you love is definitely horror. So, as he said, I thought it was interesting. You know, he spent all of his money really trying to make this, flew to all these conventions far away and met someone who ended up being his agent. I'm just curious, have you ever met anyone at a convention who's then become part of your writing career or life?
I have across the board. I mean, this podcast started with me running into Jay Thorne at the Horror Writers Convention. Two of my agents have come from relationships, you know, at conventions and things like that. Like I knew them for years at conventions before I actually signed with them. You know, I could probably trace everything back in my career to, you know, contacts and just maintaining those, you know, some type of relationship with those people over years and years.
I met the two of you at the same convention at the same time. And I think most of the relationships that I have in the industry came from meeting people at conferences, and podcasts. You know, a lot of my contacts came because of the Wordslinger podcast. But that ultimately led to me going to all these conferences. So it's a huge resource. You know, authors should, I don't put yourself in the hole to do it, but if you can get yourself into a conference, or failing that, at least bar con a conference. Go and stay in the hotel and hang out at the bar and just talk to all the people who come through. If nothing else, that you'll start growing in contacts.
Well, just it opens so many, you know, like you're stuck behind a desk all by yourself trying to solve these problems. So first you write the book, and then you have to publish the book, and then you try to figure out how to market. And none of this is new. You know, people have been doing this forever in this industry. And I think when you go to your very first conference, that's when you actually realize that. You sit at a table or at, you know, at the bar or whatever with 10 other people that have been there, done that, and can give you advice and save you months, if not years, of aggravation.
Yeah, absolutely. I think most people that I know I have met at a conference that are part of my writing life and career. So, yeah, that's super cool. JD and I actually met at a conference first, but he didn't remember, so that's fine.
I am the worst when it comes to remembering people at these things.
Well, and Christine, you and I talked about it, but like I didn't realize you were the one that I because you were talking about Kindle Vella.
Serial fiction, yeah. I saw I
Yeah.
was presenting at that conference, yeah.
And I didn't realize that that was you until we'd been doing this show for like a couple of years, I think, before I realized that that was you. So,
Yeah. But these things all come back around and you make great friends too. So it's fantastic. Okay, I guess with that, JD, who is up next week?
next week, we've got Eduardo Ballerini coming on. Eduardo is an award-winning actor and audiobook narrator. He's also a personal favorite of mine. He did my 4MK Thriller series as well as Behind a Closed Door. He's going to fill us in on the quickly changing audiobook landscape and where he thinks it's going. So if you're an author with audiobooks, you definitely won't want to miss this one. Eduardo Ballerini.
Sounds great. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.